And after a brief technical delay, we are back with yet another episode of the Cult It or Can It podcast. My guest host tonight will be...
Nick.
Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
No problem, anytime. Tonight we are going to talk about one of your favorite awesomely bad movies. I have my favorites and you have yours, and they're often different. So tonight we've gone with one of your favorite awesomely bad movies, and that is 1997's...
Batman and Robin.
Directed by...
Joel Schumacher.
Joel Schumacher, who in recent years, as we had discussed on some on a part of the podcast that we just lost, that is now irretrievable, has recently done movies like Phone Booth with Colin Farrell, which we both said that we liked, The Phantom of the Opera with Gerard Butler from 300 as the Phantom, which is okay, but it's really, really long, and it's really kind of self-indulgent.
I've never actually seen it, so I cannot comment on that one.
I really like the female protagonist. I believe she's played by Emmy Rossum. She's very, very good and very pretty. It also has Patrick Wilson, who would go on to become Night Owl in the Watchmen film adaptation. But anyway, he also his most recent kind of big movie was The Number 23 with Jim Carrey, which was a huge flop.
Yeah, I guess he has a movie that's coming out called 12, stars 50 Cent. So, you know, it's bound to be good. And Emma Roberts.
If 50 Cent is in it, that means I am probably not going to watch it.
But, yeah.
We should talk about Batman and Robin. George Clooney as Batman. And we should talk about how George Clooney was cast. Now, I'm sure that you know this, Nick, because you're up on these things. But maybe some of our listeners out there don't know how it was cast.
It's a great story. It needs to be discussed.
Apparently... Schumacher was looking through like a People magazine, and he was like, okay, who should be Batman? So he was like using his hand to cover the top half of actors' faces so that he could only see like their mouths and chins, so it would be like their face is covered with the bat mask. And he was like, okay, who looks the best like this? And he apparently settled on George Clooney.
You know, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, I honestly think George Clooney, given a better script or something like that, could have actually pulled off Bruce Wayne Batman very, very well.
There's no doubt in my mind that George Clooney would have been an excellent, excellent Bruce Wayne. I mean, he's got the whole real-life Playboy thing going on. He's not a married guy. He kind of jumps from woman to woman. He's got this very public persona and public image. He's very picky and choosy about the kinds of films that he does now. He's very active, like, in political and social causes. He, by all means, if with a better script, he could have totally nailed Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. I mean, if there's ever, like, a real, like, vigilante out there that is very Batman-like, I would pick, oh, I know who it is. It's got to be George Clooney.
It's George Clooney. Yeah, right. It's either George Clooney or Angelina Jolie. One of those two. Who is not in this movie. But Uma Thurman is in this movie. She plays the role of Poison Ivy, one of the... What, three villains from this film?
Well, two main villains and one kind of side villain.
Two main bosses and a mini boss. Arnold Schwarzenegger plays that other main villain. He plays Mr. Freeze. Perhaps his very, very worst film role. I think that's
And that's saying a lot considering it's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris O'Donnell reprises his role as Robin. I was thinking about Chris O'Donnell's career today for some reason, and I was thinking like Chris O'Donnell has got to be like number one on a list of actors who have had prolific careers but have absolutely no charisma or screen presence. And Sam Worthington is working his way up that list. Alicia Silverstone makes an appearance in this film for inexplicable reasons, probably to draw in the young female demographic because she was hot off of Clueless, which was a big hit in around the time that Batman and Robin was released. Michael Goh returns as the role of Alfred. It's his final performance as Alfred, if I'm not mistaken. There is one more cameo that we should note. No, I was going to say Jesse the Body Ventura.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Makes a cameo as an Arkham Asylum prison guard at the end of the film.
And how do you say her name? Vivica A. Fox or...
Vivica, it's Vivica.
Vivica, let me set that one over. Vivica A. Fox also makes a short, inexplicable appearances as Mr. Freeze's one of his henchmen who appears in one scene and then disappears for the rest of the movie.
Well, that's actually kind of a little inside thing, because if you remember in Batman Forever, Drew Barrymore appears in one scene as one of Two-Face's, you know, hoes, or whatever you want to call
them. Yeah, Sugar and Spice.
Yeah, she makes an inexplicable appearance. We should say, just as one little last thing, supermodel Elle McPherson plays Batman's girlfriend. What is she in, like, two scenes in the whole movie?
Yeah, actually, I guess she was supposedly in more scenes, but they got cut.
They got cut. We should talk about the production of this movie, because the production behind this film is fascinating. It was one of Hollywood's worst-kept secrets after this film proved to be, like, a massive critical disaster, that Warner Brothers really wrangled control away from Joel Schumacher during the production. I don't think that Joel Schumacher is a particularly good director, although he has made movies that I've enjoyed, but I have a hard time believing that he's as bad of a director as this film would kind of like make him look. If you read some of the production gossip from behind the film, Warner Brothers was really pushing him to make a more family-friendly Batman, because Tim Burton's Batman films were both very dark. They had fantastical elements to them, but they were ultimately pretty dark and violent. And then Batman Forever, there was some camp there, but it was also kind of a dark film as well. So Warner Brothers was really pushing him to make a family-friendly, toy-friendly, merchandise-crazy movie. And Schumacher really had a problem with this, so much so to the fact that after this movie had come out and people were basically upset with him and kind of calling for his head in some circles, he wanted to direct the next Batman movie so that he could make up for it, but he obviously wasn't given that opportunity.
A little bit more about that, if I may.
Oh, please.
Like, when Batman Returns came out, there was a lot of, even though it made decent money, reviews, there was a lot of backlash against it because people felt it was too dark. So obviously they lightened up Batman Forever, which was a huge hit.
Right.
I think people seem to think that after Burton left, the Batman films were just, they were terrible and they made no money and blah, blah, blah. Batman Forever was actually very successful as a film.
Batman Forever was, I believe, the highest grossing film of 1995, if I'm not mistaken.
There you go.
I actually think Batman Forever is a bit underrated as a comic book movie.
I'll agree with you on that. I like Batman Forever. I mean, Batman fans, I could see where they might get upset because Two-Face isn't really Two-Face, and the Riddler is really not the Riddler. They're like Joker knockoffs, essentially. But I it's a decent movie, I think. But
it's a very competent summer blockbuster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some critics have also slammed Schumacher for inserting what they call homosexual innuendo into the film. Schumacher is homosexual. He makes no secret of that. He is out, and his films tended to be quite flamboyant and campy at times. I never really got that from this movie, and I know a lot about LGBT culture, especially in America, but I never really got the whole homosexual Batman thing. In fact, I think some of the comics from 40 and 50 years ago have a lot more unintentional homoerotic subtext to them than either of the Schumacher Batman films do. And I know that the bat suits have the nipples, and yeah, that's ridiculous. And I know that much of the movie, Batman and Robin are arguing and fighting and trying to keep their relationship together as it's falling apart throughout the film. But I really, really, really think that critics are reaching too hard to look for some kind of homosexual agenda in Batman and Robin. I just don't think that it's there. I really think it's grasping at straws.
I agree with you 100%. I know the nipples on the costume might have been a little goofy, a little overboard, but as Schumacher explains, and honestly, I believe him on this, he says he wanted to compare it to the ancient Greek statues, how they display the perfect bodies. That's what he was going for. Was it misguided? Maybe. No, I don't think. I think people are looking too deep for a homosexual interpretation.
I think so, too. I really think that this film is deserving of a critical reevaluation. There have been other films that came out in this era which were really derided by critics and audiences that were really campy. I'm thinking specifically of think of Showgirls, the Paul Verhoeven movie. And in recent years they've been given like complete critical reevaluations. So they're kind of seen as like campy cult classics now. And mm-hmm. and Batman and Robin really hasn't had that happen to it yet. You do see a lot of the Mr. Freeze I used to see you style quotes. Like you see them all over the internet. It's a running gag on the TV board of 4chan, for example, and it's also a running gag on the AV Club comment talkbacks. You see it pop up. That's kind of like maybe perhaps the film's funniest legacy in a lot of ways. But this film, I do think, is deserving of a critical reevaluation. We should talk a little bit about the plot. Basically...
Oh, can I do the plot?
Absolutely.
Awesome. I've seen this movie so many times, I think I got this shit down. Well, Batman and Robin face off against the evil Mr. Freeze, you know, robbing various places for diamonds to not only power his freeze suit, because he has a bizarre symptom that where he has to keep his body at a ridiculously low temperature, but also to use the diamonds to arm his mega weapon that he will try to freeze the world, so the world will give in to his ransom demand so he could further his research to save his dying wife. Meanwhile, the other villain, Poison Ivy, becomes this megalomaniac, evil person who can kiss people and cause them to die due to her bloodstream having poison in it. She decides that the human beings are evil and need to be eradicated from the earth so plants can live again. She teams up with Mr. Freeze, so the two of them decide to destroy the world, and she will then rebuild the world with plants. Yes, I realize these two characters are polar opposites. Go with it.
I like your unintentional use of the word polar there.
But I've been watching this movie too much. It's a pun. The end.
There's kind of a plot hole that I thought of just as you were discussing going through the plot
just
of the film.
Just one?
Well, there are multiple, that goes without saying, but this was a new one. I mean, Alfred was sick, and his boss is a billionaire. Why did he not just... And by the way, obviously Bruce Wayne and Alfred care for each other a lot. We all know that. Why did he not just go to Bruce Wayne and say, hey, buddy, I've got this disease. Think you could, like, maybe throw $10 million into research? Maybe develop some kind of a cure? Or
you know, the movie kind of addresses that because Alfred's been keeping it secret. And in fairness, I think that seems to be a legitimate... For like an older person, they don't want to worry their people who they view as their sons or family. Oh, I'm sick. Don't worry about it. And Bruce Wayne goes up and like, Alfred, why didn't you tell me about it? I can get you the best doctors. And Alfred's like, oh, I've seen the best doctors. No one can save me. They kind of like just sweep it away. It's like a blink and you miss it. And
it's like a total throwaway line.
Yeah. Oh, it's great.
I can remember, this film came out in 1997. It was one of the first big summer movies that was released that year. It came out like the first week of June 1997. And I can remember driving up to, I wasn't driving obviously because I was only 14. I was a passenger in a car that my mom was driving up to Wisconsin because we drove up there to pick up my brother Luke from Bible camp. I was listening to the radio. I was listening to talk radio because I was that kind of a kid. You know, I would put on, I would rather listen to like WGN talk radio than listen to like FM crappy pop music. Well, I was listening to Siskel and Ebert on the radio actually, and they were reviewing this movie. And I don't remember which one of the two. I'm sure that it'd be very easy to look it up and find out. But one of these two guys actually gave this movie a thumbs up.
No, they both gave it a thumbs down. Are you sure about that?
I'm pretty sure about that.
Because I recently watched the YouTube, the review of this movie was on YouTube, and they both gave this a thumbs down.
Really?
I'm dead serious.
I'll have to go back and check on that. I totally trust your judgment. I do seem to remember one of the two guys, and I think that it was Siskel. One of the two guys, like, kind of damning it with faint praise. And talking about how, yeah, it's goofy and it's campy, but it's a comic book movie, and comic book movies are supposed to be goofy and campy. And I can remember listening to it as a 14-year-old, and I loved Batman. I loved Batman. I remember when I was not old enough to go see the original one, because it was PG-13, and I was only like 6 or 7 when it came out, because it came out in like 89.
Yeah.
I think it was 89, right?
Yeah, it was 89.
It was one of those huge summer of 89 movies.
Oh yeah, that was like the movie, like.
Yeah, like we'll never have one of those again, I don't think. But I was unable to go see it because I was just too young. My parents wouldn't let me go see it. But when it came out on video, they let me watch it with them, like, you know, because I was just a kid. My parents were pretty strict about not letting me see movies that they considered too mature, you know. Which I think that not enough parents are actually like that. So.
Yeah, that's fair enough on your parents' part.
When Batman Returns came out, I think I was like 10 years old, or like 9 years old, turning 10. So they let me go see that. So I got to go see that. I went with some of my older cousins to see it, my cousin Jesse. And I was just so psyched to just be in the theater and watch Batman. It was like the greatest thing. And then Batman Forever came out, and I was a bit older. I was like 12 or 13. But it was good because Jim Carrey was really popular, and he was funny, and he was coming off of like Ace Ventura and Dumb and Dumber, and I was so psyched. And I really liked that movie a lot. And Tommy Lee Jones, I thought he was great in it. And I really liked that they had included Robin. You know, there was kind of like a logical progression of story. So when this came out in theaters, I was 14 years old, and I remember being totally psyched to see it. And I had heard that review and on the radio, and that kind of dismayed me a bit. But still, I was like, they're professional critics, and you know, they might not like a movie like this or whatever. You know, this movie's not really meant for. It's not an Academy Award winner. And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna love this. This is gonna be great. I go to see it with like my two good friends, and I can remember the exact moment where like my heart kind of broke because it was so bad. It was when they clicked their heels and ice skates popped out of their boots.
Inexplicable ice skates.
I just remember, I was 14. I was 14, and I remember thinking, wow, that is so stupid. And, like, I was a part of that film's core demographic. That film should have spoken to me. It should have made me want to go out and, like, buy the tie-in merchandise and, you know, sing the film's praises. When you're a 14-year-old, you think that everything is awesome. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, no movie is bad. This was the first time I can ever remember sitting in a theater and feeling like I had been ripped off by a movie studio. And I can't stress enough that, like, this film was designed for me. Like, Warner Brothers made this film for, like, you know, males between the ages of, like, 11 and 17. You know, that demographic right there. And if someone in their core demographic was looking at this and saying, wow, this is dumb, like, you know they failed. And if you look at, like, if you look at the opening of the film, it opened really, really, really high. It opened with, like, $42 million, which doesn't sound a lot in 2010, but was a huge number in 1997. And then the next week, it plunged 63%. Films just didn't do that. Films do that now, like a movie
that's,
will...
That's the norm, though.
Yeah. Films do that now, like a movie will open with like $60 million and then like drop like by 50% for the next week. That doesn't happen. That didn't happen in the late 90s with movies like this.
Yeah.
Movies would stick around for weeks at the box office.
I agree with you totally.
I can remember the media making a big deal of how My Best Friend's Wedding was outgrossing Batman and Robin. Like, how could that happen? how could a crappy romantic comedy with Julia Roberts and her giant fucking smile do better than a Batman movie? Like, it was unthinkable. Like, they really killed the franchise with this. This was the death of the Burtonverse Batman movies.
Yeah. I remember the animated tie-in from the popular Batman animated series, like Batman and Mr. Freeze Sub-Zero, and it was a cartoon based in the animated series that was meant to come out around the same time because it had Mr. Freeze and Batman. It was meant to be a tie-in. There's a rumor that, see, this movie got pushed back by like a good year before being released, and there's a rumor that Warner Brothers saw that the animated movie was superior in every way possible than the live-action movie that this movie was meant to supplement, not overtake. And so they pushed it back just so people wouldn't be going to see that theoretically for a cheaper price than coming to see the big film.
That is amazing.
I don't know how true it is, but again, take it with a grain of salt. Knowing the way movie studios think, I wouldn't be surprised if that wouldn't be true.
Right. Yeah, I could definitely see that. I also want to talk about how this film had a budget of $140 million. And
yeah.
that's just a crazy number for a movie from the 90s. Like, even Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, cost significantly less than that. That was a movie that came out just 2 years after this. I mean, $140 million, that's a lot to make a movie nowadays, like a big special effects blockbuster.
Yep.
Nowadays. The new Clash of the Titans movie, which was released last week, cost less than what Batman and Robin cost to make. And again, this film was from 1997. To me, like, that's just, like, that's incredible to me, just thinking of that, about how much they spent on this movie, on the production design and the special effects and the things like that. And it just comes out just being just an awful, awful film.
Yeah. I gotta say, even though physics doesn't play any role in this film whatsoever during the action sequences, I gotta say I like how the action is done. I think it's well done, it's well edited. I think like the opening sequence with Batman and Robin jump into the museum and fight Mr. Freeze's thugs who mysteriously all know how to skate and play hockey. I think that's a well done action sequence. I think most of the sequences in there are well done. I thought the effects for a 1997 movie were actually pretty good. Were they worth $140 million? Probably not, but I think production-wise, the movie is pretty... It holds up, I think, today.
I do want to also talk about a few of the good things in this movie. I don't want to just focus on the bad, because I don't think that this movie is entirely a waste. I do think that it has its good points, and I think that a lot of times we tend to look over those because, you know, the public just had such a vitriolic reaction to this film. We talked earlier a bit about George Clooney's performance as Bruce Wayne, Batman. I do think that he does the best with the material that he's given. I mean, Clooney is almost always charming and affable in any role that he's in. And mm-hmm. and some of that is able to shine through in this. You had mentioned the special effects and how the choreography and the fight choreography and how they looked particularly good. Even somewhat, they still look somewhat good for this film being 13 years old. I should also say that I do like Miles Goh's, that's his name, right? Miles Goh?
I think that's how you pronounce his last name.
Or Goff?
I always said Michael Goff.
Michael Goff, that's what I'll call him from now on. I do like his performance as Alfred. I like his performance as Alfred in all four of the, I call it the Burtonverse Batman movies, even though Schumacher directed two of them. But I don't think that Joel Schumacher is a particularly bad filmmaker. I think he's a very good choreographer, like we had mentioned with some of the action scenes. And even though it's ridiculous that they're fighting a hockey team for some reason, it at least looks good. It's well choreographed. And you had mentioned the editing, too, how this film does have some pretty good editing, despite the fact that there are absolutely no laws of physics left unbroken. Just to focus on some of the things. Plus, there are some little touches of humor. I do enjoy Mr. Freeze's cheesy one-liners, probably on a more ironic level than anything else.
Yeah, let's kick some ice. You're not sending me to the cooler.
You're not sending me to the cooler.
the one thing I do like about this movie is that it so throws itself into, like, a pure camp comic book universe.
It does.
Like there's a scene where Poison Ivy's like kicked to the side and she's like, "Curses!" And there's like another scene, like another Arnold Schwarzenegger line. It's like, "Hello, my name is Freeze. Remember that well, for it will be the harbinger of your doom." I mean, I can't help but like smile and laugh at that.
I'm afraid my condition has left me cold to your pleas of mercy. I think that somebody, like, for YouTube, someone should make a comedy trailer for Batman and Robin.
Someone out there edited down Batman and Robin to, like, all of Mr. Freeze's, like, catchphrases, punchlines, and it's like a 2-minute video of just him doing it. I've watched it so many times because it puts a smile on my face.
This is why Superman works alone.
Which was actually that line, the preceding line, like, I want a car, chicks dig a car, was a reference to Batman and Robin when Batman said the same thing to Nicole Kidman's character. Like From Batman Forever, I'm sorry.
I don't remember that line.
It's just a quick throwaway line. She's hitting on him and Batman's like, it's the car, right? Chicks dig the car. And
you know what else actually looks good about the movie? I actually like the way that Mr. Freeze looks, the blue makeup.
Yeah, he does look pretty badass.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I kind of like it. I mean, make no mistake about it. Schwarzenegger is terrible as Mr. Freeze.
You know, I almost wonder. I've mentioned this on past things, and it's something I fully believe in. Like, people say that Uma Thurman was terrible as Poison Ivy, that Arnold Schwarzenegger was terrible as Mr. Freeze. But look at the script. Look at what they're having them doing. Are they really that bad, or are they just playing it up because that's how they're interpreting how this story is going?
You know what Schwarzenegger was doing in between takes of this movie? He was counting the $20 million he got to be in it. And you know what Clooney was doing in between takes? He was buying an island in the Bahamas.
Wasn't this like one of Clooney's first major leading roles in film?
It might have been his very, very first action film and perhaps his second leading role. We should also say that this movie goes on for 2+ hours. It is really long.
Yeah. They try to cram way too much stuff in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should talk about that, even though this podcast is getting long. But should we go ahead and Coulter can this movie, Nick?
I suppose so.
All right, I'll go ahead and go first because we are running a little bit long, so... We're at 35 minutes, and I usually like to keep the podcast between 20 and 25 minutes long. So, yeah, this is a film that came out when I was kind of at the height of my amazement for special effects and comic book movies. You know, I was 14 years old. It should have, you know, directly spoken to me, but instead it kind of turned me into a bitter shell of a moviegoer. This is the movie that started off the, wow, maybe a big summer movie can be terrible, you know, and for that I have to can the movie. It's just it's not very good. It is awesomely bad, Nick, and I feel the same way about the G.I. Joe The Rise of Cobra that you do about this movie. Like, I really think that movie is totally awesomely bad. This movie is just bad. bad. Yeah, I definitely have to can this film for all the reasons that we've already gone over.
You know, as much as I love how awful this movie is, and I think any Batman fan owes it to themselves to check this movie out just because of the awfulness is so complex in this movie that it's baffling. You know, I too will have to give it a can it, but on the other hand, if you want to see something so bizarre, so amazingly bad, that your brain will explode from confusion, then I recommend it on that level.
This has been the Cult or Can It podcast. For our website, check us out at cultitorcanit.blogspot.com. Feel free to email us at cultitorcanit@gmail.com. Let us know what you think. Let us know if there are any movies you would like us to cover in the future. We're always happy to have suggestions. I'm always looking for guest hosts to bring some new blood to the podcast, so don't be shy. It just takes a Skype connection and a microphone to talk into. Let us know if you'd like to be a part of what we've got going on here. So for my co-host...
I'm trying to think of a nice related pun, but...
I am your host, Zach, and I'm saying thank you for listening to the Cult of the Cannon podcast, and we hope you have a better one.
Winter has come at last.
No, it's spring, damn it. All right, we're done.